Don't fool yourself into thinking you've given a lot of benefits if you're not uncovering and meeting those explicit needs. 3. Be careful with new products. Most of us give far too many features and advantages when we're selling new products. Don't let this happen to you. Instead, the first thing to ask yourself about any new product is, what problems does it solve? When you understand the problems it solves, you can plan spin questions to develop explicit needs. Try it. You'll be much more effective. Answers. Types of product statements. 1. Feature. Balanced voltage stabilization is a fact about the system. The statement doesn't explain how stabilization can be used or can help the customer. 2. Advantage. The statement shows how the feature in statement 1 can be used or can help the customer. It's not a benefit because the customer hasn't expressed an explicit need for stabilization. 3. Advantage. The statement shows how backup memory can be used or can help the customer, so it's more than just a feature. But because there's no evidence that the customer has expressed an explicit need for backup memory, we can't call it a benefit. 4. Feature. Statements of cost, like this one, are facts or data about the product, so we classify them as features. 5. Benefit. In the previous statement, the customer has expressed an explicit need. I need to be able to read source data straight into memory. In this statement, the seller shows how the product meets that explicit need. 6. Benefit. Again, the buyer has stated an explicit need, an error rate less than 1 in 100,000. The seller shows that his product can easily meet the need. 7. Advantage. The seller shows another way in which having a low error rate can be used or can help the customer. However, as the next customer statement shows, this doesn't meet a need. 8. Feature. A piece of data about the product. 9. Feature. Further product facts. 10. Advantage. The seller shows how the feature of time-based coding can be used to help the customer. Chapter 6. Preventing Objections. During a visit to the training center of a leading multinational company, I was invited to watch some sales training in progress. Instead of choosing the Advanced Systems Selling class, as my hosts had perhaps expected, I asked instead if I could sit in on a typical Basic Skills program for new salespeople. Entering quietly at the back of the room, I looked around. The students all had that unnatural attentive cleanliness that goes with being new to sales. Their instructor, recently promoted from the field, was launching with great vigor into his favorite topic, objection handling. You couldn't have imagined a more typical scene. It could have been day two at any basic sales training program in any large corporation. The professional salesperson, the instructor began, welcomes objections because they are a sign of customer interest. In fact, the more objections you get, the easier it will be for you to sell. The class, duly impressed, wrote this down. Meanwhile, I groaned behind my mandatory visitor's smile. Here was yet another new generation of salespeople at the receiving end of one of the most misleading myths in selling. Still, as a visitor, it would have been improper for me to comment, so I continued to smile through an hour of objection handling techniques until the coffee break. During the break, I talked with the instructor. Did you believe what you were saying in there? I asked. That stuff about the more objections, the easier to sell? Yes, he replied. If I didn't believe it, I wouldn't be teaching it. I hesitated. Clearly, the instructor and I had opposite views about objection handling. It would have been easier to drop the subject, but he'd been kind enough to let me into his class, so I felt I owed him something in return. I asked, "You've been a successful sales performer for several years, haven't you?" "Yes," he replied with some pride. "I've been with the company 5 years, and I've made president clubs for the last 3. "Look back at your own sales experience," I urged him. 5 years ago, when you were new, did you receive more or fewer objections from your customers than you're getting now?" He thought for a moment. "More, I guess." Then, as he remembered back, he added, "You know, in the 2 years when I was new, I seemed to get objections all the time." "So in those first 2 years when you were facing all those objections, did you have good sales figures?" "No," he said uncomfortably. "In fact, my sales weren't too good until my 3rd year with the company." Pressing the point, I asked him, "Then you did a lot better in that 3rd year. "Yes, that was the 1st year I made President's Club." "And how about objections? It sounds as if you had more objections in your unsuccessful years. How does that tie in with what you said in class about the more objections, the more successful the call will be? He considered the point for a while and said, "You're right. When I look back, I faced more objections when I was unsuccessful. Perhaps I'm teaching the wrong message." I had to admire him. Most people, given the astonishing human capacity for dismissing unwanted evidence, would have dodged the issue and held to their initial position. But the class was reconvening, and I had to start my tour of the facility, so I didn't have time to talk more with the instructor about objection handling. If we'd had more time, I would have told him, "Objection handling is a much less important skill than most training makes it out to be. Objections, contrary to common belief, are more often created by the seller than the customer. In the average sales team, there's usually one salesperson who receives 10 times as many objections per selling hour as another person in the same team. Skilled people receive fewer objections because they have learned objection prevention, not objection handling." To explain these findings, I'll have to go back to the discussion of features, advantages, and benefits in Chapter 5. You'll remember the definitions of these three behaviors and their links to success in sales of different sizes. Figure 6.1 summarizes the three behaviors in a table. Features describe facts, data, and product characteristics. They have a slightly positive impact on small sales and a neutral or slightly negative impact on larger sales. Advantages, type A benefits, show how products, services, or their features can be used to help the customer. They have a positive impact on small sales and a slightly positive impact on larger sales. Benefits, type B benefits, show how products or services meet explicit needs expressed by the customer. They have a very positive impact on both small and larger sales. One of my colleagues, Linda Marsh, carried out some correlation studies to check whether there are statistically significant links between each of these behaviors and the most probable responses they produce from customers. For example, when sellers use a lot of features in calls, do customers respond in a different way than in calls where fewer features are used? She discovered that features, advantages, and benefits each produce a different behavioral response from customers. Figure 6.2 shows the most probable effects of features, advantages, and benefits on customers, which are, respectively, prime concerns, objections, and support or approval. Features and price concerns. Customers are most likely to raise price concerns in calls where the seller gives lots of features. Why is this? It seems that the effect of features is to increase the customer's sensitivity to price. This isn't necessarily a bad thing if you happen to be selling low-cost products that are relatively rich in features. Consider the psychology of the advertisement shown in Figure 6.3, which shows an ad for a men's calculator watch, a low-cost product rich in features. Next to an image of the watch is a list of 11 features. The sale price is $9.95. This features-rich product is being sold in a way that works well with cheaper goods. You can imagine a television commercial. "We give you multiplication, division, subtraction, and what do you think that's worth? Well, don't answer yet, because we also get markup and markdown percentages, which is something you don't usually find on watches 10 times the price, and we give you..." Throughout history, using features this way has helped sell lower-priced goods. Why? Because features increase price sensitivity. By listing all the features, the customer comes to expect a higher price. When the product turns out to be much cheaper than its competition, the increased price sensitivity causes the buyer to feel extra positive about the lower price tag. I chose a watch example rather than an industrial product because there's something unique about watches. In no other market that I can think of is there such an enormous price difference between competitors. Now consider the advertisement shown in Figure 6.4, a high-cost product for which listing features is a negative. The photographs show a man's and a woman's LaSalle watch around the stem of a glass of champagne with the text, "La Romantique, à LaSalle, the heritage is obvious." This watch is almost 100 times as expensive as the one in Figure 6.3. Do you think you'd be more likely to buy the expensive watch if there was a list of features down the side of the advertisement to help persuade you? Not on your life. With top-of-the-market products, the price concern created by features will make people less likely to buy. A list of features would probably make you ask yourself questions about whether the expensive watch was worth it. Too many features, a case study. The relationship between features and price concerns isn't just a theoretical point that applies only to advertisers. It has clear implications for sales strategy. A major U.S.-based multinational corporation once called us in to help us with a problem. The corporation had been facing tough Japanese competition in its primary marketplace, particularly at the lower end of its product range. The Japanese products were richly featured and, as you might expect, somewhat less expensive than its own machines. As market share began to erode, the corporation looked for alternatives to price cutting. One attractive possibility was to introduce a new product with more features that could compete directly with the Japanese machines. Such a machine would still be a little more expensive, but because of its added features, it would provide a much stronger marketplace offering. But who would sell this new product? The corporations decided to recruit part of the sales force from the competition. After all, nobody knew as much about how to sell these richly featured machines as the people who'd been successful sellers for the Japanese competitor. It seemed, on the face of it, a plausible strategy, recruiting experienced sellers while simultaneously weakening the competition by raiding its best people. The corporation's agents approached those salespeople who'd been very successful selling the cheaper Japanese machines and succeeded in recruiting some of the competitor's top people. Unfortunately, these new people's sales results were deeply disappointing. The competition's superstars performed no better than the existing sales force. While trying to discover what was going wrong, I talked with several of the people recruited from the competition and found them puzzled and dejected at their sudden fall from success. "It's price," they explained. "The product's too expensive. We get price objections all the time." And they were right. When we traveled with them on calls, we found that the number of price objections they received from customers was 30% higher than for the rest of the sales force who were selling the same product. Why? We couldn't write it off as pure coincidence when two sections of a sales force selling an identical product received different levels of price objections from their customers. The answer lay in their use of features. While selling for the cheaper competitor, these salespeople had developed a selling style very high in features. This was very successful because, as we've seen, features increase customers' price concerns. But because their product was cheaper, the price concern worked on their advantage. Now that they were selling for a more expensive competitor, the high level of features they were giving worked against them. Their features increased price concern and, because their product was more expensive, this turned customers toward the cheaper competitor. I presented our findings to the VP of sales for the division. As he wryly remarked, "Right now they seem to be doing a better job of selling for our competition than when our competition employed them." How could we help? Not, I suggested, by teaching them how to handle price objections. That was just a symptom. It would be more effective to treat the cause and help these new people adopt a selling style more appropriate to a top-of-the-market product. So we retrained them in spin questioning techniques so that they could use a high benefits style. As a result, their sales increased, price objections dropped, and the price issues were soon forgotten. Treating symptoms or treating causes? Let me introduce a theme that I'll come back to several times in this chapter. Curing a selling problem, just like curing a disease, rests on finding and treating the cause rather than the symptoms. When I was 9 years old, I lived in Borneo. A friend of my own age warned me that there was a typhoid epidemic in the village. All that either of us knew about typhoid was that it caused a burning fever. "But I won't catch it," he assured me. "I'm eating a lot of ice cream to keep cool." I followed his example and caught typhoid from infected ice cream. One of the few things I remember clearly about my month seriously ill in the hospital was my father explaining to me the differences between symptoms, such as a high temperature, and causes, such as the nasty little bacterium, Salmonella typhosa, that loves to lurk in ice cream. Perhaps this episode made me unduly sensitive to treating symptoms when you should be watching out for causes. But just suppose we'd run a program to teach those salespeople clever answers to price objections. Would we have achieved anything? I think not. The customer's price concern was just a symptom. The cause was giving too many features. Teaching objection handling skills would do no more to prevent price concerns than eating ice cream would prevent typhoid. Advantages and objections. Perhaps the most fascinating of the links that Linda Marsha found is the strong relationship between advantages and objections. You'll remember that advantages are statements that show how products or their features can be used or can help the customer. Statements that many of us have been trained to call benefits. Chapter 5 showed that advantages have a positive effect on small sales, but a much less positive effect when the sale grows larger. And Linda's discovery offers a partial explanation of this. Advantages create objections, and this is one reason why they are poorly linked to success in the large sale. To help understand the link between advantages and objections, consider the following extracts from an actual sales call. I've edited out references to the company, and I've cut the length of some statements. Otherwise, this exact sequence of behaviors happened in a call we recorded in Dallas in September 1981. The product being sold is a word processor. Seller, problem question. Does all this retyping waste time? Buyer, implied need. Yeah, some. But there's not so much of it here, not like in Fort Worth. Seller, advantage. Here's where our word processors would be a real big help, because they'd eliminate that retyping for you. Buyer, objection. Look, we retype stuff, sure, but you won't get me paying for fancy $15,000 machines just to cut down on some retyping. Seller, advantage. I understand you, but the labor costs of retyping can climb out of sight. A big plus of word processors is that they save you money by making your people more efficient. Buyer, objection. We're very efficient right now, and if I wanted to do better on efficiency, I can think of 16 ways without new word processors. I have 2 so-and-so word processors there in the back office. Nobody much knows how to use them. They give trouble. Just trouble. Seller, problem question. Those such-and-such machines are hard for your people to use? Buyer, implied need. Yes, it's quicker to type it out by hand, doing it the old way. Seller, advantage. We really can help you there. Our so-and-so machines use a screen so people can see exactly what they're doing. That's a lot better than your old ones where you've got to remember things like format codes, which we prompt automatically so that our machine can be used much more easily. Buyer, objection. Know what? Some of the ladies working here get uptight about a typewriter with a correcting ribbon. Screen? It'd just confuse the hell out of them. I'd end up with more mistakes than I'm getting now. Seller, problem question. You're getting too many mistakes? Buyer, implied need. Some. Well, no more than most offices, but more than I'd like. Seller, advantage. Tests show that with the full screen editing and error correction we offer, your error rates would drop by more than 20% if you used our machines. Buyer, objection. Yeah, but it's not worth all that hassle just to get rid of a few typos. What's happened here? The first thing you'll notice is that every advantage is followed by an objection. Of course, I've chosen this extract to illustrate my point, for objections don't always follow advantages the way they do in the example I've picked here. Sometimes the seller will use an advantage that brings a favorable response from the customer. But from our research, objections are a more likely response than any other buyer behavior. Figure 6.5 shows a progression of creating objections. First, the seller asks a problem question. Does retyping waste time? The buyer replies with an implied need. Yeah, some. The seller then gives an advantage. Word processing eliminates typing. The buyer then considers the value equation. No retyping versus $15,000, where the latter tips the scale to the don't buy side and the buyer concludes that it is not worth it. The buyer raises the objection, I won't pay $15,000. The next thing to notice about this example is the characteristic sequence of behaviors. Problem question, implied need, objection. We found this sequence happening over and over again in unsuccessful calls. Let's look more closely at what's going on. As you can see, the fundamental problem that's causing the objection is that the seller offered a solution before building up the need. The buyer doesn't feel that the problem has enough value to merit such an expensive solution. Consequently, when the seller gives the advantage, the buyer raises an objection. This explains why advantages have a more positive effect in small sales. If the word processor had cost $15 instead of $15,000, the buyer would probably have reacted differently. It's certainly worth $15 to eliminate retyping, but $15,000? That's a different matter. Back to symptoms and causes. How would you help the seller in our example? It's tempting to suggest that because she is receiving so many objections, what she needs is better objection handling skills. So, for example, we could teach her principles of objection handling, the classic technique of acknowledging, rephrasing, and answering. Or we could teach her specific help with the common objections that customers raise by showing her what to say when customers raise such typical objections as, "Your word processors are too expensive," "Word processors are hard to use," "My people would be resistant to word processors," "Word processors are more hassle than they're worth." Either of these options would help her handle future objections better. But are we treating the symptom or the cause? In each case, in the example, the objection rose because the seller hadn't built sufficient value before offering solutions. Teaching her how to handle objections treats the symptom, but it doesn't alter the cause. The fundamental selling disease, jumping in too soon with solutions, remains malignant and untreated. The cure. If objection handling just treats a symptom, how would we set about a complete cure? This is where the spin model comes in. By teaching her to probe in a way that builds value, we can prevent the objection from arising in the first place. Let me show you what I mean, using the final objection in the example. First, let's examine why the customer raised the objection in the first place. Seller, problem question. You're getting too many mistakes? Buyer, implied need. Some, well, no more than most offices, but more than I like. Seller, advantage. Tests show that with the full screen editing and error correction we offer, your error rates would drop by more than 20% if you used our machine. Buyer, objection. Yeah, but it's not worth all that hassle just to get rid of a few typos. The customer has raised the objection because he doesn't perceive sufficient value from reducing the error rate. If you could draw a value equation diagram to show what was going on in the customer's mind, it would probably look like the one in figure 6.6. The figure shows a value equation called how the customer sees it, where $15,000 and hassle outweigh fewer typos, tipping the scale to the don't buy side. The hassle greatly outweighs the value of eliminating a few mistakes, so the customer makes a negative judgment and raises an objection. Even the best objection handling skills can't alter the fact that the seller has offered a solution without first building value. Let's look at how a more skilled person would handle the same situation. Seller, problem question. You're getting too many mistakes? Buyer, implied need. Some, well, no more than most offices, but more than I like. Seller, implication question. You say more than you'd like. Does this mean that some of those mistakes are causing you difficulties in documents you send out to clients? Buyer, sometimes that's happened, but not too often, because I proofread all important documents carefully before I send them out. Seller, implication question. Doesn't that take up a lot of your time? Buyer, too much, but it's better than letting a document go with a mistake, particularly if it's a mistake in the figures that go out to a client. Seller, implication question. Why would that be? Are you saying that a mistake in the figures would lead to more serious consequences with clients than a mistake in the text would? Buyer, oh yes. We could lose a bid or commit ourselves to an uneconomic contract or even just come across to clients as sloppy. People judge you on things like that. That's why it's worth a couple of hours a day proofreading when there's other things I should be doing. Seller, need payoff question. Suppose you didn't have to spend that time proofreading. What could you do with the time you saved? Buyer, well, I could give some time to training my office people. Seller, need payoff question. And this training would lead to improved productivity? Buyer, oh, very much. At the moment, you see, people don't know how to use some of the equipment here, that graph plotter, for example, so they have to wait until I'm free to do it. Seller, implication question. So the time you're spending in proofing also forces you to become a bottleneck for other people's work? Buyer, yes, I'm badly overloaded. Seller, need payoff question. Then anything that reduced the time you're spending in proofing wouldn't just help you, it would also help the productivity of others. Buyer, right. Seller, need payoff question. I can see how by reducing proofreading, you could ease the present bottleneck. Is there any other way that having fewer mistakes in documents would help you? Buyer, sure. People here hate retyping. It might be a plus in terms of their motivation if fewer mistakes meant less time spent in retyping. Seller, need payoff question. And presumably less time in retyping would also bring cost savings? Buyer, you're right, and that's something I need to do. Seller, summarizing. So it seems that the present level of mistakes is leading to expensive retyping, which creates a motivation problem with your people. If mistakes, particularly in figures, get out to your clients, it can be very damaging. You're trying to prevent that at the moment by spending 2 hours a day proofing all key documents. But that's turning you into a bottleneck, reducing everyone's productivity and preventing you from putting time into training your staff. Buyer, when you put it that way, those mistakes in documents are really hurting us. We can't just ignore the problem. I've got to do something about it. Seller, benefit. Then let me show you how our word processor would help you cut mistakes and reduce proofing. If you were to re-examine the customer's value equation now, it would probably look like the one in Figure 6.7. The customer develops a new point of view, where improved motivation, increased productivity, less proofing, time to train staff, and fewer typos now outweigh the $15,000 and hassle, tipping the scale to the buy side. Now the cost and hassle are more than counterbalanced by the value the seller has created through the use of implication and need payoff questions. It's a much more effective piece of selling because we've attacked the cause of the objection. As a result, the objection doesn't even arise. Objection prevention turns out to be a superior strategy to objection handling. Objection prevention, a case study. I can imagine people reading this and saying to themselves, yes, it all sounds very plausible when Rockham's making up examples that suit his case, but I'm not sure it holds up in the real world. As a further piece of evidence, then, I'd like to share with you one of the most fascinating little investigations I was ever involved with. The company was a well-known high-tech corporation whose personnel research staff had been investigating sales behavior in one of its divisions based in the southern United States. We had encouraged the research staff to use the behavior analysis method of counting how often the key seller and customer behaviors occurred during sales calls, and they had come up with a curious finding. The average sales team in the division consisted of 8 salespeople. Now, purely in terms of statistical probabilities, you'd expect that these 8 people, each selling the same product to the same size of customer and with the same competitors, would each face approximately the same number of objections per selling hour. Not so. There was an enormous difference in the number of objections faced by individual salespeople. In the average team, they often found one salesperson having to face 10 times as many objections per selling hour as other people from the same team. The research staff didn't know about our work on the links between advantages and objections. Naturally, they drew the obvious conclusion. The people who were receiving so many objections must need training in objection handling. They asked us for advice. One quick look at their data told us what we needed to know. We picked the behavior analysis figure for 10 people who were each reviewing very high numbers of objections and who were clearly candidates for objection handling training. In all 10 cases, these people were higher than average in the number of advantages they used in their calls. I persuaded the company to try a bold experiment. What I'd like to do, I explained, is to train these people in objection prevention. I think we can design a program which doesn't even mention the word objection, but which will do more for these people than the best objection handling training ever could. The company agreed. We chose 8 salespeople who, from the behavior analysis figures, had each received an unusually high level of objections from customers. As we'd promised, our training didn't say anything at all about objections or objection handling. Instead, we taught the 8 people to develop explicit needs with the SPIN model and then to offer benefits. After the training, the company's researchers went out with the 8 to count the number of objections they were now receiving in calls. The average number of objections per selling hour had fallen by 55%. I'd draw 2 conclusions from this little study. It confirms that the best way to handle objections is through prevention. Treat the cause, not the symptom. Notice that our training didn't prevent objections completely. There will always be objections that arise because the customer has needs your product can't meet, or because a competitor has a clear product superiority. These true objections are facts of life, and no objection prevention technique can do anything to stop them from being raised. However, what we were able to show in this case was that objections can be cut by more than half by using the spin behaviors to build value. The sales training approach to objections. Traditional sales training actually teaches people to create objections, then teaches them techniques for handling the objections they've inadvertently created. This is because the selling skills models in every major sales training program we've reviewed have been based on the small sale. As we've seen, in small sales, a high level of advantages can be successful because there's less need to build value before offering solutions. But in larger sales, advantages don't have this positive impact. It's important to remember that we're using the term advantage to cover any statement that shows how your product or service can be used or can help the customer. In other words, what we're calling an advantage is what most sales training calls a benefit. It's my hope, as training designers begin to understand that larger sales need different skills, that we'll see an end to the kind of training that encourages salespeople to give a lot of advantages. The heavy use of advantages, which is what most training recommends, is the cause of more than half of the objections that customers raise. But are objections necessarily bad? Some sales training programs and many sales trainers, such as the instructor I described at the first of this chapter, teach that objections are positively linked to success and that the more you get, the better. If that's true, then preventing objections could actually hurt your selling. What does the evidence tell us? We carried out a study to find out whether objections were really sales opportunities in disguise, as one training program put it. We counted the number of objections raised by customers in a sample of 694 calls collected from an international sample in a large business machines corporation. Figure 6.8 shows the results. As you can see, the higher the percentage of objections in the customer's behavior, the less likely that the call will succeed. If objections are sales opportunities in disguise, then this study suggests that their disguise must have been created by a master in camouflage. No, make no mistake about it. The more objections you get in a call, the less likely you are to be successful. It's a comforting myth for trainers to tell inexperienced salespeople that professionals welcome objections as a sign of customer interest, but in reality, an objection is a barrier between you and your customer. However skillfully you dismantle this barrier through objection handling, it would be smarter not to have created it in the first place. Benefits and support/approval. The most positive relationship to emerge from Linda Marsh's study of features, advantages, and benefits is the strong link between giving benefits and receiving expressions of approval or support from customers. She found that the more benefits the sellers gave, the more approving statements their customers made. This isn't a surprising finding. After all, benefits, as we define them, involve showing how you can meet an explicit need that the customer has expressed. Unless the customer first says, "I want it," you can't give a benefit. It's no wonder that customers are most likely to express approval when you show you can give them something they want. Objection handling versus objection prevention. At its most basic, what I've suggested in this chapter is that the old objection handling strategies, which encourage the seller to give advantages, are much less successful in the larger sale than objection prevention strategies, where the seller first develops value using implication and need payoff questions before offering capabilities. When I was new to selling, I thought that, next to closing, objection handling skills were the ones most crucial to sales success. Looking back, I can now see that my concern was motivated by the large number of objections I was facing from my customers. I didn't ask myself what caused the objections, but just knew that there were lots of them. So I better improve my objection handling. I now understand that the majority of objections I faced were only a symptom caused by poor selling. By improving my probing skills, I've become more successful at objection prevention, and this has certainly helped me sell more successfully. I still get objections, of course, for in selling there will always be the potential for a genuine mismatch between customer needs and what a seller can offer. So objection handling skills will always have a part to play in all my calls. But the reason I sell better now isn't better objection handling skills. It's that I'm less likely to create unnecessary objections. Preventing objections from your customers. If you're receiving more objections from customers than you'd like, think about which is symptom and which is cause. Could it be that objections are just a symptom you've caused by offering your solutions too soon in the call? Try putting in extra effort into effective needs development using implication and needs payoff questions. If you can build the value of your solutions, then you're much less likely to face objections. As many hundreds of salespeople we've trained will testify, good questioning skills will do more to help you with objections than any objection handling techniques ever could. Of course, you'll always get some objections, especially when your product doesn't meet a customer's needs. However, there are two sure signs that you're getting unnecessary objections that can be prevented by better questioning. 1. Objections early in the call. Customers rarely object to questions unless you've found a particularly offensive way to ask them. Most objections are to solutions that don't fit needs. If you're getting a lot of objections early in the call, it probably means that instead of asking questions, you've been prematurely offering solutions and capabilities. The cure is simple enough. Don't talk about solutions until you've asked enough questions to develop strong needs. 2. Objections about value. If most of the objections you receive raise doubts about the value of what you offer, then there's a good chance that you're not developing needs strongly enough. Typical value objections would be, it's too expensive. I don't think it's worth the trouble of changing from our existing supplier. Or, we're happy with our existing system. In cases like these, customer objections tell you that you haven't succeeded in building a strong need. The solution lies in better needs development, not in objection handling. Particularly if you're getting a lot of price objections, cut down on the use of features and, instead, concentrate on asking problem, implication, and need payoff questions. Chapter 7. Preliminaries. Opening the call. In this chapter, I want to examine preliminaries more closely. To be honest, the Huthwaite research team didn't find the preliminary stage of the call very exciting when compared with the central areas of investigating and demonstrating capability. Perhaps this is our personal bias. At any rate, it meant that we did much less research about this stage than about the other three. Figure 7.1 highlights preliminaries in the table of the four stages of a sales call, which also includes investigating, demonstrating capability, and obtaining commitment. Nevertheless, even the limited data we did collect showed that successful ways of opening the call in a small sale are different from those which work best as the size of the sale increases. How important is the warming up stage of the call? In our research on preliminaries, we sought the answers to a number of questions, including these. Is it true that the first impression made in a sales call are crucial to its success? Do the openings that work in smaller sales work equally well in larger ones? Does one particular way work better than others to open your call? Before examining these questions, I should note that in discussing preliminaries in a larger sale, this chapter simplifies the situation by talking mainly about first meetings with new customers. As we know, of course, most larger sales involve several calls and are likely to be with customers with whom we already have an established relationship. With some major account groups I've known, less than 5% of their calls were first-time meetings with new customers. However, the factors that influence preliminaries in the multi-call sale have not, to my knowledge, been researched by anyone. It seems likely that as the selling cycle progresses, whether with old or new customers, the impact of preliminaries diminishes because the relationship has become well established. But nobody knows for sure, and I'd prefer to avoid speculation. Consequently, I'm going to concentrate on areas where some data exists. Although we don't have research about the impact of preliminaries across a whole sales cycle, we do have information about opening first calls on new customers in both large and small sales. First impressions. There's evidence to suggest that people notice far less in the early stages of an interaction than we may imagine. Many of the older books on selling emphasize the importance of a smart appearance and suggest that first impressions will make or break the sale. But most of the recent research suggests that initial appearances are far less important than these older writers have claimed. This is not to say that it pays to be scruffy or unpresentable. A reasonable standard of dress is probably sensible. But don't believe that tiny details will make a big difference in your sales success in the preliminary stage of the sale. As we've seen, the far more important and more durable impressions are made during the investigating stage. In the early stages of an interaction with another person, we're usually so overloaded with information that we either don't notice or we quickly forget some quite obvious things. How often have you been introduced to someone and, 10 seconds later, forgotten his or her name? Why should you forget something as important as a name? Because your mind is full of other things, such as what you're going to say next. You literally don't have room for all the details available to you. Many potentially important impressions get crowded out in the opening minutes of a meeting. It's hard to get accurate data on the importance of first impressions, so let me give you my personal opinion from having watched the openings of many hundreds of sales calls. Over and over again, I've seen successful calls that started in a nondescript or even awkward manner, and I've seen tremendously smooth openings lead nowhere. Over the years, I've come to doubt the importance of first impressions during the preliminary stage of the call. I no longer believe that first impressions can make or break your sales success in larger sales. Now, it may be that such things as dress or opening words do matter in very small sales. A friend of mine was raising money for a charity by door-to-door selling of Christmas cards. I believe him when he claims that there was a direct relationship between how his volunteers dressed and how much they sold. One day, he told me, he insisted that they all wear their best clothes. Sales went up by 20%. But don't expect a smart suit and a good opening sentence to add 20% to your sales volume if you're in major account selling. Conventional openings. Since the 1920s, salespeople have been taught that there are two successful ways to open a call. Relate to the buyer's personal interests. The conventional sales wisdom says that if you can somehow tap into an area of personal interest, then you can form a relationship more quickly and the call will be more successful. For example, if your buyer has a photograph of children on the desk, discuss family interests. If there's a golf trophy in the office, talk golf. Make an opening benefit statement. Begin with some dramatic statement about the benefits your product can offer. For example, you might say, "Ms. Customer, in today's marketplace, productivity is the central concern of key executives like yourself, and our product will contribute to your productivity?" Our evidence suggests that, while these two methods might be successful in smaller sales, there's little to show that they help you when the sale is larger. Let's review this evidence. Relating to personal interests. In one of Huthwaite's early studies, carried out in part of the Imperial Group, we were trying to establish whether salespeople who built good relationships would, as a result, make more sales. We found that sellers who dealt successfully with small retail outlets in rural areas seemed to rely heavily on personal factors in their selling. We measured the number of times each seller referred to some fact or incident related to the customer's personal life. For example, the seller might ask, "How's Anne enjoying her riding lessons?" or "Is Joe's leg better yet?" In rural areas where the size of sale was small, successful sellers used more of these personal references than did sellers who were less successful. So we could safely conclude that the old advice is right. If you can relate to points of personal interest, it will help your selling. But it was a different story in the large urban stores, where the average sale was more than 5 times the size. We found no relationship between success and reference to personal issues. Therefore, it seemed that relating to the buyer's personal interests might be a less effective technique in larger sales. But I wasn't particularly satisfied with the study. For a number of technical reasons, we had to be cautious about our interpretation. For example, the rural salespeople generally had longer tenure and a lower turnover rate. This meant that they had been on the job longer and thus had had more opportunity to find out personal things about their customers. And the rural customers themselves were less busy than their large urban counterparts, so they had more time to talk. Nevertheless, this study raised some questions. It was possibly true in the 1920s, when the theory was first put forward, that people bought from those they related to personally. Friends did business with friends. But even in the mere 15 years I've been studying selling, I've noticed a distinct change. 15 years ago, buyers would tell me, "I buy from Fred because I like him." Now I'm much more likely to hear, "I like Fred, but I buy from his competition because they're cheaper." it seems that personal loyalty is no longer an adequate basis for doing business. There's another reason why it may not be successful to open the call around a personal point. I once worked with the Central Purchasing Group of British Petroleum. On the wall of his office, one of the buyers had a picture of a racing yacht. "I keep it there because it improves my efficiency," he told me. Puzzled, I asked him to explain. "I get salespeople coming in here every day," he said, "wasting my time by talking about a lot of non-business issues. Obviously, they're fishing for some personal area that will catch my interest. But I'm a busy professional purchaser, and I couldn't get through the day if I wasted time on conversation that isn't directly business-related. So I use the picture to increase my productivity. When new sales reps visit me for the first time, they usually say, 'What a beautiful picture. You must really enjoy sailing.' I reply, 'I hate sailing. That picture's there to remind me how much time gets wasted out on the water. Now, what did you want to see me about?'" Perhaps that's an extreme case, but I've heard many other professional buyers complain about salespeople who try to open calls by cultivating areas of personal interest. The last thing a busy buyer wants is to tell the 10th seller of the day all about his last game of golf. The more senior the people you're selling to, the more they feel their time is at a premium, and the more impatience you're likely to generate if you dwell on non-business areas. And there's another reason. Many buyers become suspicious of people who begin by raising areas of personal interest. They feel that the seller's motives aren't genuine, and that it's an attempt to manipulate them. I'm not saying that you should never begin a sales call by talking about a buyer's personal interests. Sometimes, particularly if the buyer takes the lead in raising an area, it's the right thing to do. And as we've seen, in smaller sales, there can be an overall positive impact on sales success from raising personal issues. But as a general piece of advice, I suggest that you be careful not to overuse this method in larger sales. The opening benefit statement. Many sales training programs teach that the most effective way to begin the call is to make an opening benefit statement to catch the buyer's interest with some potential benefit of your product or service. So I might say, "Mr. Wilson, for a busy executive like yourself, I know that time is money, and I'm sure you waste a lot of time looking up telephone numbers and dialing calls. With the Rackham Auto Dialer, I could help save some of that time for you." If it's well done, an opening benefit statement can sound positive and businesslike, but is it an effective way to open calls? Although the idea of the opening benefit statement is quite old, I've been able to trace it back 30 years, and it might even go back further than that. Its great popularity as an opening was brought about by the Xerox Learning Systems Program, Professional Selling Skills, PSS. This program was very widely used, and its developers claimed that research showed that calls were more likely to be successful if they started this way, using, as they called it, an initial benefit statement. I haven't seen the detailed research, so I can't comment on its validity, but I do know that the investigation on which the program was based took place in the pharmaceutical industry, where the average call length was a mere 6 minutes. If you've only 6 minutes of buyer time, then I could certainly see why you would need a punchy way to get straight into the substance of your call. But would the same be true in larger sales, where the average individual call length is 40 minutes? Huthwaite set out to investigate this. We watched just over 300 calls, noting whether or not the seller used an opening benefit statement. Then, using the procedure described in Chapter 1, we divided the calls into those which succeeded and those which failed. If opening benefit statements made calls more successful, as the PSS program claimed, then we should expect to find that the calls which failed had fewer opening benefit statements than those which succeeded. This is not what we found. In our studies, there was no relationship, one way or another, between the use of opening benefit statements and the success of the call. Why should this useful-sounding method, the opening benefit statement, not be related to success in some way? We decided to look more closely. What we found was this. The most effective salespeople we studied opened each call in a different way. Sometimes they might use an opening benefit statement, but frequently they would use some other starting point. Less effective people were the ones who tended to open each call in the same way. So those sellers who began every call with an opening benefit statement were likely to be less successful than those who just used the technique occasionally. Larger sales mean multiple calls, often several on the same customer. So it's particularly important not to use a standard opening more than once with the same person. I can recall how impressed I was with a salesperson from an office products company when he first called on me. He began with a classic opening benefit statement. "Mr. Rackham, you're a busy executive, and I'm sure you're wondering whether it's worth 15 minutes of your time to talk with me, but if, as a result of those 15 minutes, you could save your company several thousand dollars, I'm sure you'd agree that it would be time well spent." So I gave him 15 minutes and was sufficiently impressed with his product to invite him back the following week to talk to us again. At the next meeting, with my office manager present, he began, "Mr. Rackham, I know you're busy, but if I could use 15 minutes of your time to show you how I could save your company thousands of dollars." The very opening that had made such a positive impression the first time around now sounded mechanical and irritating. There's another reason why the opening benefit statement may be ineffective. Successful salespeople talk about their products or services late in the sales call, but we've seen that less successful people begin talking products and solutions very much earlier in the call. I remind you of this point here because it raises one of the dangers of using opening benefit statements. Take this simple example. Seller, using opening benefit statement. "Mr. Buzzard, we at Big Co. know how important it is to produce professional-looking documents in a business like yours. That's why we invented the ExecuType typewriter. Using a special new system, the ExecuType gives a far finer finish to your documents than you can get from conventional word processors." Buyer, asking the questions. "Oh, does it use a daisy wheel?" Seller, drawn into giving product details. "Nope, it's an inkjet process." Buyer, still asking the questions. "Inkjet? That must be very expensive, Ms. Simpson. What does it cost?" Seller, forced into a price issue early in the call. Well, it is a little more expensive than conventional methods, but it's also got..." What happened here? By making an opening benefit statement, the seller has been trapped in two ways. She's been forced to talk about product details too early in the sale, before she's had an opportunity to build value by using spin questions. She's allowed the buyer to ask the questions and has therefore allowed him to take control of the discussion. Neither of these traps is irreversible. If she's smart, Ms. Simpson will recover the call, take over the questioning role from the buyer, and turn attention away from the product and back toward the customer's needs. But at the very least, this isn't a good way to begin the sale. Yet I've personally seen many calls start this way because the seller used an opening benefit statement. A framework for opening the call. So far, much of this chapter has been negative, how not to handle the preliminary stage of the call. Let's turn our attention to the positives. What does Huthwaite's research recommend as the best way to open calls? Obviously, as I've suggested, variety is important. There isn't one best opening technique, but there is a framework that successful people use. Focusing on your objective. Let's examine the objective of the preliminary stage of a call. What's the purpose of your opening? At its very simplest, what you're trying to do is get the customer's consent to move on to the next phase, the investigating phase. You want customers to agree that it's legitimate for you to ask them some questions. In order to do this, you must establish who you are, why you're there, but not by giving product details, your right to ask questions. Obviously, there are many ways to open the call, but the common factor of most good openings is that they lead the customer to agree that you should ask questions. In doing so, good openings keep you from getting into detailed discussions of products or services. Early in the call, you want to establish your role as the seeker of information and the buyer's role as the giver. Making your preliminaries effective. Preliminaries, as we've seen, don't play a crucial role in the larger sale. The most important test of whether you're handling preliminaries effectively is whether your customers are generally happy to move ahead and answer your questions. If so, then you're probably handling this stage of the call acceptably. Don't worry about appearing smooth and polished. Some of the best salespeople we've studied have seemed nervous, self-conscious, or hesitant in the early minutes of the call. But do be concerned about these three points. 1. Get down to business quickly. Don't dawdle. The preliminary stage is not the most productive part of the call for you or for the customer. A common mistake, particularly for inexperienced salespeople, is spending too long on pleasantries. As a result, the call runs short of time. The customer has to stop when you're getting to a critical point. If you find that your calls often run out of time, it's worth asking yourself whether you're getting down to business quickly enough. While there's no exact measure for how long it should take to open a call, I'd be worried by anyone who consistently spent more than 20% of the call time on preliminaries. Don't feel that you'll offend customers by getting down to business quickly. A complaint I frequently hear from senior executives and professional buyers is that salespeople waste their time with idle chatter. I don't think I've ever heard the complaint that a salesperson gets down to business too quickly. 2. Don't talk about solutions too soon. One of the most common faults in selling is talking about your solutions and capabilities too early in the call. As we've seen in previous chapters, offering solutions too soon causes objections and greatly reduces the chances that the call will succeed. How often do you find yourself discussing your products, services, or solutions with the customer during the first half of the call? If it happens frequently, then it may be a sign that you're not handling the preliminaries effectively. If, in your case, it's usually the customer who is asking the questions and you're in the role of providing facts and explanations, then it's likely that you've not sufficiently established your role as a questioner during the preliminaries. Ask yourself whether your call opening establishes that you should be asking the questions. If it doesn't establish this, change the way you open calls so that the customer accepts that you'll be asking some questions before you talk about the capabilities you can offer. 3. Concentrate on questions. Never forget that the preliminaries aren't the most important part of the call. Often, when I've been traveling with salespeople, I've noticed that they waste time before a call worrying about how they should open it, when they could be using that time far more effectively to plan some questions instead. Chapter 8, Turning Theory into Practice. One of my favorite words, entelechy, is so little known that listeners reach for a dictionary whenever I use it. That's a pity, because the word fills a serious gap in the English language and deserves to be in everyday circulation. It means the becoming actual of what was potential, turning something into practical usefulness as opposed to theoretical elegance. Entelechy is the subject of this chapter, turning the potentials of Huthwaite's research into actions that will be practically useful to you in your selling. There's no easy way to convert theoretical models into practical skills. The fact that you're reading this book doesn't mean that the knowledge you're gaining will automatically translate itself into improved selling abilities. No book on selling will, of itself, improve your selling skills any more than reading a book about swimming will teach you how to swim. The challenge for both author and reader in any book, with pretensions to being practical, is entelechy, turning theory into practical action. To meet my part of the challenge, I'll draw on Huthwaite's worldwide experience of training many thousands of people to improve their selling skills. In this chapter, I'll share with you some of the principles and practices that have worked successfully for us and for our clients. Your challenge is a tougher one. Because improving your skill is hard work, there's no instant formula for better selling. Success in any skill, whether in golf, playing the piano, or selling, rests on concentrated, tedious, and frustrating practice. It's quite realistic for you to expect a significant increase in your sales results if you follow the advice in this book and really practice the skills. But this is the tough bit. For each reader who practices adequately, a dozen are likely to fall by the wayside. The 4 golden rules for learning skills. Why do people find it so difficult to learn skills? It's not just because of the hard work, for we're accustomed to putting work into learning new knowledge. You've demonstrated the ability to work hard already through the time and energy you've invested in reading this book, in acquiring knowledge about how to sell. Yet I wonder how many readers will invest an equivalent amount of effort in turning their knowledge into practice. The sad fact is that we generally work harder and more effectively to learn knowledge than to translate our knowledge into skills. Perhaps entelechy is such a rare word because it refers to something we so rarely do. It's my personal belief that the main reason why people have such trouble improving their skills is that they've never thought about the basic techniques of skill learning. At school, our success depended on developing techniques for learning knowledge, and most of us got quite good at it. But what did school do to help us learn skills systematically? With the exception of sports, the answer for most people is little or nothing. So before I talk about what skills you should practice, it will be useful to begin with how. How can you learn any skill efficiently and with minimum pain? We have found that most people can greatly improve their ability to learn skills if they stick by four simple rules. Rule 1. Practice only one behavior at a time. Most people, when they work on improving their skills, try to do too much at once. I can imagine